Today on Vox Talks, how COVID-19 will reshape European economic policy. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. The COVID-19 crisis was the third crisis in a decade that threatened European unity. But the response to COVID-19 was more ambitious and coherent than to the financial or migration crises that preceded it. Why was that? And will this temporary breakthrough lead to deeper economic integration in Europe? This is the subject of a new CEPR policy insight called The Legacy of the Pandemic, how COVID-19 is reshaping economic policy in the EU. Marco Buti of the European Commission and George Papakonstantino of the School of Transnational Governance at the European University Institute are the authors. And George is here with me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Was I right to say that the crisis response this time's been more decisive? I was thinking back to this time last year, and there were some pretty fierce disagreements going on, weren't there?
Well, indeed, in the first instance, we had some hiccups. But overall, I think as far as the economic policy response, it is very different, much more coherent, much more timely. And that's both at the national level, where countries had an unprecedented aggressively fiscal response, as well as relaxing state rules, for example, for loan guarantees to firms to make sure they would not go under. But also at the EU level, with the response of the ECB, which did in 2 months what it took it 2 years to do back 10 years ago, as well as the European Council, which broke new ground with its decisions.
In the paper, you've picked three ways that this policy response has been different. And first of all, you are arguing that there is a new paradigm for macro policy. So what conventional wisdom from a decade ago has been jettisoned this time round?
I think it would be fair to say that macro and macro policy has moved quite a long way since the global financial crisis. I mean, for one thing, we now understand the macro financial linkages much more than we did before and how important the financial sector is to the rest of the economy. We now understand we are probably in a secular stagnation kind of environment with low interest rates, which require a kind of propping up aggregate demand altogether. And there's a number of policy implications that come out. The first one is the overall fiscal stance, where it's understandable that it needs to be more aggressive than in different environments, especially with low interest rates. A second is a new understanding of the notion of the sustainability of public debt. It's no longer the debt to GDP ratio, it's the ability to service the debt. And again, in low interest rates, that's different. And perhaps a third is the interplay between the fiscal and monetary policy, which are no longer as clearly distinct as we thought they were, and that brings to the fore a new, more assertive role of central banks, but also central banks making it clear to governments that they cannot be doing all the job for them, and fiscal policy has also got to play an important role.
Now, secondly, you also point out that this isn't a crisis that one nation can blame on another nation in Europe. Is this just tolerance, or is there real evidence that members are choosing solidarity this time over their national interests?
I think that 10 years ago in the Eurozone crisis, the narrative that prevailed was that of moral hazard. And we haven't seen this time around because this is a different crisis. It's not policy induced. You cannot claim that countries are paying for mistakes that they made in policy in the past. And I think we have seen some remarkable shifts. We've seen that the group of the so-called frugals no longer has as its leader Germany, which shifted and sided with France in making some breakthrough proposals, which eventually led to the Commission proposals and the Council decisions. Now, you might want to call this enlightened self-interest, or indeed an understanding that in an environment like the one we have now, you need more solidarity across the Union with new tools. And we are seeing this, and this is a significant change.
And mention of the frugals does bring to mind that Europe has learned from the mistakes of the financial crisis. You point this out as well. What are the policies where everyone now feels comfortable saying, we did that, it was a mistake, let's not ever do that again?
I think we have learned a number of things. The first one is that in deep crisis, monetary policy has got to be very aggressive and be there for the long haul. So that's something that we've learned, and the ECB has learned very, very, very clearly from the previous crisis. The second is that austerity should not be overdone. In the previous crisis, even countries that had fiscal space did not use it, because we were all in a different mindset. Yes, my own country needed to consolidate, but not everyone did needed to in the Eurozone. And perhaps a third important lesson as we are coming to the end of the COVID crisis is that one should not pull back the fiscal effort too early. Because when you do that, you do not allow the economy to breathe and be able to grow again. So if you pull back too early, you're going to find yourself in difficult circumstances.
So let's have a look at where you see economic policy going in Europe. You're arguing, first of all, that this could create a shift in attitudes on the role of the state. Every country at the moment, not just in Europe, they're having this debate. Which parts do you think are particularly relevant in the European policy context?
Both in the political discussion and the economic policy discussion, I think the sort of shifting balance between state and market is going to be with us for some time. You can see that in the national debate, for example, on minimum wages, on the progressiveness of the tax system, on the need for wealth taxes. And you can also see it on the European level in terms of how you defend and provide European public goods. And health is clearly one of those. So I think we are seeing the shift everywhere, including in the US. So practically every single European country. Now, where exactly the balance will lie will, of course, depend on preference, and preferences are diverse, right? We don't expect everyone to move in the same pace in the same direction. But the movement, I think, is quite clear in every country.
But yes, George, isn't this still a national question to sort out, or even a regional one? Why is it part of the European agenda?
I think it's both a national and a European issue. Of course, as preferences are diverse, different countries will find different solutions and different points of equilibrium between where they want to provide public services by the state and where the market will do most of the provision. But at the European level, we're having a quite robust discussion about a European health union. We are discussing the issue of strategic autonomy, which beyond its geopolitical aspect has clearly economic aspects relating to European global value chains, relating to having sufficient local production in critical sectors. So there is an element that going beyond pure health policy and into economic policy that has a European dimension beyond the national one.
I was interested to see that you're advocating a stronger role for the EU in the global economic agenda, where it traditionally hasn't had a very loud voice. Is this possible? Does Europe speak with one voice yet?
I would say increasingly so, though I don't want to oversell this. Well, in certain areas, and trade is an example, of course we speak with one voice by design, right? In other areas, for example, taxation, it is perhaps less the case, but now with the US push towards minimum corporate taxation, that may be the case where we do. In establishing a stronger international role for the euro, the Eurozone countries do speak with one voice. And here also we're seeing a shift, a more, for example, assertive stance on this by the ECB, willing to talk much more about this. The understanding that we have to link particular policies, for example, how we do our payments for energy products, to giving a stronger international role for the euro. So across a number of issues, and of course, you know, in other issues in the global agenda, from climate to digital, on climate, I think we do speak with one voice, with digital almost so, not exactly. I do not want to downplay national differences, but I do think that if we want to play a bigger role in what is, you know, geopolitics in flux at the moment and the big structural change that are ahead, we have to be speaking more with one voice.
Wherever you look now, there are some fascinating, really important policy debates going on about topics like a Green New Deal or what the nature of work is going to be like in the future. And there are some big policy decisions that are going to have to be made in the near future. In Europe, should the leadership be proposing radical new ideas, really leading this debate? Or is it more important right now to maintain a consensus among its members?
I think we're only now beginning to understand the kind of profound changes that will be accelerated as a result of COVID. Some were already there. I mean, obviously the green transition, the need for it was there, but certainly anything around digital and the nature of work has vastly accelerated. And we do know that there, Europe is a laggard. Therefore, I would very much encourage the European leadership, whether that's the Commission or whoever else, to try and push the envelope as much as possible, because we come into these areas from a position of weakness, and we do run the danger of falling further behind if we're not bolder than we are. I'm very happy to see that the digital and the twin transition, green and digital, is at the heart of the recovery plans of member states. But more needs to be done there, especially on what you would call European public goods that go beyond what the national states will do.
This is a very hopeful paper in some ways, because you're looking at the possibility of new ideas and a different future. But George, some people will point out that we've been this way before. And is there not a danger for Europe's institutions that the next wave of reforms, kind of like what happened with EMU and banking regulation, are left half done? Do we need the crisis to carry on long enough that we're forced to push it through to the end?
Crises do concentrate minds. And we saw that the Eurozone crisis forced us to look back on some of the weaknesses, the design weaknesses of the EMU, and try to correct them. We haven't done so fully. We've gone some way. And this new crisis helps us, A, to correct some of the mistakes of the previous one, and look more into deepening the political and economic union that we have created. But look, Europe is a work in progress, has always been. I am optimistic in the sense, and I think our paper is optimistic in the sense, that we do learn from crisis and we do manage to adapt. And resilience and adaptability are proving to be the two most important characteristics of the union. So it is those characteristics that will hopefully help us shape our institutions to be able to face the challenges that are ahead better than we've done in the past.
Very interesting, some fascinating, very important policy challenges in Europe coming up in the near future. So let's see what happens. George, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Now, you will want to read the Policy Insight. It is called, as I said, The Legacy of the Pandemic, How COVID-19 is Reshaping Economic Policy in the EU, and authors Marco Butti and George Papakonstantino. Also on Vox EU, look out for an article called Reshaping European Economic Integration in the Post-COVID World, which explains some of the themes in the Policy Insight. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you will never miss an episode. And remember, 12 years of Vox Talks now at voxeu.org/vox-talks.